Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, welcome to Horse Hour. I'm Amy Frost, and my guest today is Helen West. Helen was the youngest rider to ever compete at pre-St George level. She's also been selected for 2 consecutive young rider teams, and she won gold at the Young Rider European Championships. She's made her way up to the 4-star level of eventing, competing at Bramham, Blenheim, Burley and Chatsworth. And now Helen's the manager of Bicton Arena. On top of that, she's show jumping and she's an FEI course designer. So lots to talk to Helen about. This is Horse Hour. Welcome to the Horse Hour podcast. Our guest today is a lovely lady called Helen West. Now, she has been a 4-star eventer, she still rides, and she's the manager of Bicton Arena, which, I have to tell you, they host 2 international competitions in eventing up to CIC 2-star level. So I can't wait to find out everything that goes on behind the scenes of some of our major competitions. How are you, Helen?
Hi there. Yeah, very good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome. So I'm so keen to talk to you because we go to all these competitions and I think it's very easy to forget all the hard work that goes on behind the scenes planning them. So we will talk about your comps soon, but let's just have a little chat about you first and your eventing, because you competed up to 4-star level.
Indeed I did, yes. Well, eventing was all I wanted to do. You know, when I was at school, I always wanted to be an event rider, and I was very fortunate. I was successful as a junior and as a young rider. I rode on the British junior team and also 2 British young rider 3-day event teams.
Oh, wow.
And won one gold at the Young Rider Europeans in 2001.
That's amazing.
Seems a while ago. Yeah, showing my age. So, no, I had a great spell, and I then went on and competed at a lot of sort of big 3-day events, both in this country and abroad. Rode for lots of different owners. I was very lucky, had some very supportive owners, and had a great time with the eventing. But I just got to a stage in my life where I thought, is this what I want to be doing in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years' time? You know, took a couple of nasty enough falls and just reassessed kind of where I was at in life, really.
That does happen, you know.
It
when
does.
When you have an accident, it kind of brings it all back to reality of it is a dangerous sport, and we focus a lot on how to get over the accident and how to deal with it psychologically in our brains, but ultimately we then start thinking, well, you know, actually I don't want to die. I have children
absolutely.
To look after, I have responsibilities, and then I guess you kind of sidestep it a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. It's physically and mentally, it's a very, very tough sport. And, you know, to be at the top, you need, you know, very, very good horses. It's very expensive. I think for a lot of riders, you know, you end up riding anything that comes to you because you need to pay the bills. And, you know, certainly when you're younger, you're so desperate to be seen out there and get your foot on the ladder. You know, you'll pretty much ride anything that comes into you. And, you know, and I was lucky, I had some very good horses, but I also had some quite average horses that, you know, I had to do my best with. And perhaps horses that I knew, you know, shouldn't really be competing at a certain level. But, you know, you have to manage owners' aspirations and, you know, where they think the horse is going. And when you're a bit younger, you tend to sort of, you know, do what they're telling you to. And I just remember being in the position where I sort of set off out the start box one day and thought, gosh, you know, I think it's a bit much for this horse. I don't think it should really be at this level. And then about 5 minutes later, you had a nasty fall off it. And I remember sort of walking away from it thinking, gosh, you know, I was lucky, but hang on a minute, what's this telling me? I was right. You know, my gut instinct is right. And actually, I don't want to be in that position. I want to be able to say, no, I'm not riding that today. It's too much for him. And it's a tough one.
It's a bit of a wake-up call, really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
To feel, lots of people do feel under that pressure. And I worry about that because they're going to put themselves in situations where they're hurt. But ultimately, like you said, you have no choice because you've got to pay the bills. So unless you ride the horse, you're not making any money.
Absolutely. And I was, you know, I was in the position where I bought my first house when I was 21. So I had a mortgage from a fairly early age. Mm. And, you know, those kind of monthly bills. And whilst it was great, obviously, you know, having the income of having the horses to compete, I was only afloat for as long as I had those horses. Mm. So, you know, you needed to keep the numbers up to keep paying the bills. It was sort of, it was a bit of a, not a fairground ride, but, you know, you had your ups and your downs. And I had some months where obviously I had an awful lot of horses in. And when you're on top of the game, you're on top of the game, and confidence breeds confidence. But when, you know, things aren't quite going to plan and you're having a not such great spell, it's very tough. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I had some very loyal owners, but I've certainly seen in the sport, you know, with a lot of the younger riders, you know, if they don't tell the owners what they want to hear, you know, the horses might obviously get moved to another rider. Mm. And there's always someone that is prepared to ride them. So it's very tough for, you know, certainly for the younger riders to sort of, to be able to sort of say, actually, no.
I wonder how we can combat that. So do you think it's education for the owners? Do you think it's a little bit more understanding?
Yes, absolutely. I do, definitely. And I think, you know, perhaps, you know, the younger riders perhaps need, it's very easy to focus on, you know, training the horse and having lessons and improving your dressage and grilling them on the flat. Mm. But actually, you know, maybe some of these, you know, these younger people need help with other aspects. You know, and how to manage owners' expectations and how to communicate with them and sort of, yeah, just be assertive enough to you know, put themselves first.
I had a really great chat with Alexander Bragg a couple of weeks ago, who said exactly the same thing. He said, ultimately, you need to be honest with the owners.
Yes.
Don't feel under pressure. And he said a really interesting point, actually, which was there was one owner that wanted him to push the horse a little bit. And he said, you know, this isn't necessarily right for me. Maybe this owner isn't right for me. Ultimately, if they're not going to listen to what I'm saying, then maybe that partnership between owner and rider isn't quite fitting.
Absolutely. So I would 100% agree with that. But I think that's something you come to with a little bit of age. Mm. You know, Alex would be a sort of similar age probably to myself now. And I can look back and see that very, very clearly. But at the time, you know, when I was that bit younger and so hungry and desperate to sort of get up there and achieve, it was perhaps more difficult to see. I think that clarity does come a little bit with age and a bit of confidence as well.
Yeah, and also you're paying the bills. You don't need to worry so much. You do have to worry about paying the bills, but, you know, providing your mortgage has been paid each month, you don't feel under that financial pressure so much.
Exactly.
So, now you're in a position where you can help these young riders, you can educate, you can guide them through the process with not only your competitions at Bicton, but also from your experience. So how are you taking all that, which I think is brilliant, Helen? I really do, because, you know, as everybody knows who listens to the podcast, I'm not a good rider. I wouldn't know. But I have this need to want to help people. And it's a weird thing. Maybe I'm ready for children. So having that guidance and having someone for them to turn to say, you know, that is unbiased. You know, you're not an owner. You're not a rider. You are a rider. You're not an owner.
You're not part
of their everyday paying the bills world. To be able to give that advice, how are you using your experience to help them?
Well, it's funny, actually, because, I mean, obviously, I use my experience in so many sort of different ways now in my role here at Bicton. You know, and I think what's good is that because I've been there and done it to, you know, a reasonably good level, I would like to think that people, you know, have a bit of respect for, you know, for my opinion and, you know, for where I am at. And that helps an awful lot, you know, with my kind of organizer's hat on, you know, when I make decisions for the venue or, you know, specific decisions for, you know, a type of event, you know, whether that be, you know, with the horse trials, people will ask me, you know, what's the ground like? And if I sort of say, right, well, we've done this and we've, you know, aggravated and I've done a designated strip that we haven't, you know, grazed or had any cross-country schooling on, and I would be happy to run my horse, I think people take confidence and think, oh, great. Well, if she's happy to run her horse, you know, she knows what she's talking about. And, you know, and similarly with the show jumping, because obviously I'm sort of historically an event rider. But interestingly enough, the horse I've got now, who I do compete regularly, is a very, very good jumper. And I've ended up sort of finding myself going down the show jumping route a bit, which is a little bit foreign territory for me. But I've jumped some, you know, some quite big stuff on him in the last couple of seasons. And it's very interesting, you know, just sort of with my show jumping hat on, trying to sort of appease some of the show jumping competitors that come here. And, you know, they're looking for better prize money, great going, all the rest. But it helps that I'm up there jumping at that level on him, because I think they realise that, you know, I wouldn't actually go and jump him on the grass, for example, if I didn't think that the going was good enough.
Yes.
So it does really help that obviously I've had that background and that I'm out there doing it. And, you know, and I think a lot of the sort of younger riders, I'd like to think that I'm pretty approachable. And, you know, certainly a lot of them do come and sort of pick my brains and ask me what I think. And, you know, it's lovely to be in a position now where I can sort of impart some of my life experience and, you know, and sort of try and help them, to not make the mistakes that I did as well, to be honest, you know.
You're going to have lots of phone calls now. People going, Helen, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. We have quite a lot of sort of, as well as, you know, the top end competitions here at Bicton, we do have a lot of grassroots. You know, we have a good unaffiliated sort of circuit, and, you know, at our July horse trials, we run from B80 up to novice. And through the winter, we do a lot of arena eventing at sort of 70, 80, 90 in a meter level. So, you know, I have a lot of people coming, and sometimes it's the first time and, you know, they don't know what to expect. And I always sort of say, look, just ask. You know, we're here to help. Just shout. You know, sometimes you see them, they've sort of arrived and they're looking around and thinking, where do I go? What do I do? And they just need, you know, a little bit of reassurance and a bit of a guiding hand to say, right, okay, first thing, go down to the secretaries, make sure your hat's tagged. And then, you know, so they don't get on the horse and then somebody say, oh, your hat's not tagged, you can't ride. You know, that stresses them right out.
Yeah.
So it's, if they know what to expect first, I just think it, you know, it gives them confidence and it makes for a much smoother day for them.
Yes.
Well, so it's managing your expectations, isn't it? And
absolutely.
When you're trying to concentrate on your test and what you have to do next, the last thing you need is a spanner thrown in the works of,
yeah,
oh, well, actually, have you signed in? What's your name? Da, da, da. I remember going to my first ever competition. I was only 9 and not having a clue what I was doing, not my parents not knowing what I was doing. And I know I was very young, but even at that age, that's kind of resonated
with
me.
Daunting.
It is.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, you know, the test is being read out. It was a dressage test. The horse wouldn't go in the arena. I didn't know which arena I was supposed to be in. I didn't know that I was supposed to have a number on my back. And it's all such basic stuff.
Yeah.
But I feel what I'm feeling, what I'm getting from riders now that are starting their competitions, even as adults, is exactly the same. They have no idea what they're supposed to do. Now, we go as spectators. And we go and watch to get in the atmosphere and to know what we're, you know, what it's going to feel like and where everything's laid out. But those basic rules of going to the secretary's office, where do the horse boxes go? When do you have to book a stable? All that kind of stuff. You don't know until you actually go there for the first time to compete.
No, exactly. We've just, interestingly, actually, a couple of weeks ago, we ran a pet plan dressage area final. And, you know, a lot of those riders, you know, it's perhaps the first time they've qualified and it's a really big achievement for them and it's a championship. And before, you know, when they actually entered, we sent out a sort of fact sheet and sort of lots of bullet points just to help them, give them the information and, you know, how to book a stable, whether there was bedding, whether they can buy things. What time the arena walks were, that sort of thing.
Brilliant.
Just so that, you know, and I think as a venue, I think, you know, that does help. It does help the competitors a lot.
Mm. And how nice for you as well, coming from an eventing background, you're jumping into show jumping and you get to be involved in dressage too. Now, I know that you obviously did a dressage through your eventing, but dressage as its own discipline is totally different, isn't it?
Well, it is, absolutely. And interestingly, actually, my background before I was eventing was very much dressage.
Oh.
I actually rode on the pony dressage team.
Oh, did you? Gosh.
Yeah, I did.
How did you fit all this in?
I know. Well, you see, in my day, you had to be 16 to event.
Mm.
So I was desperate to get out there and event, but I wasn't old enough. And I was very fortunate. I was given a very good dressage pony on loan, actually, when I was probably about 11 or 12. And I thought it was, honestly, looking back, it was hilarious because my parents ran a livery yard at the time. And I remember we'd gone and picked this pony up and we got back and we had no idea what we had here. Okay. And the pony had been on like three pony British dressage teams.
Wow.
And we thought, oh, you know, he looked nice. And, you know, obviously he's seen some photos and thought, oh, great. Anyway, we got this pony home. And I remember going in the school the next day and one of our liveries who was, you know, quite keen on dressage and she helped me a lot when I was younger.
Mm.
We went out and she was like, right, okay, well, try a flying change. I was like, well, how do I do that? Well, I don't really know. Just change the bend a bit. Go from one way to the other. Yeah, honestly, looking back, it was absolutely hysterical because we had this pony. And in fairness, he was actually a really difficult pony to ride. He was very, very cunning and he gave you the bare minimum.
Mm.
So I actually did learn an awful lot from him because he made you work for every single, you know. But I was, I actually ended up riding at pre-St. George level on him when I was 12.
Oh, my goodness.
Looking back, that was quite an achievement. So, I do have a strong interest in dressage. I've kind of always thought, after I'd have finished eventing, I thought I would come back to dressage.
Mm.
And it's funny how, you know, obviously at the minute, I'm sort of more show jumping because of the horse I've got. But I can still sort of see myself probably in future years coming back to the dressage because I do really enjoy it.
It's like an addiction, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
You just want more all the time. Let me have a bit of that. Let me have a bit of that.
And life would be so much easier if we didn't, you know. I think, God, I'd be so much better off.
Yeah.
I'd have so much more time. I'd be less stressed. But, oh, no, you just keep coming back for more.
Mm. So what's it like being an organiser then, you know, going from competing to now you're running the show, Helen?
Absolutely. Do you know what? I, as a rider for so many years, I can honestly say I had no idea how much goes on behind the scenes and what goes into making an event run.
Mm.
And I'm almost embarrassed to think how ignorant I was for all those years. I'd just rock up at an event and, you know, expect it to be of a standard and expect everything to be, you know, just so.
Mm.
But until you've been on the other side of the fence, you just have no idea how much goes into it. And certainly, like with the horse trials, how many volunteers we rely on.
Mm.
You know, our volunteer base is just huge. You know, and these are people just giving up their time, giving up their day to come and, you know, be a road crossing steward, come and fence judge for us, you know, come and take the teas and coffees round.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Just absolutely, because, you know, this is unpaid.
Mm.
And it's interesting because that's one of the real differences I find between the disciplines. You know, with the horse trials, pretty much everybody here is a volunteer.
Wow.
Whereas for the show jumping shows, everybody is paid. You couldn't. It's such a different. It's such a different mentality. It's fascinating. For the sort of, you know, for the show jumping shows, everybody's paid, from the from the ring stewards to the arena party to the poo pickers, everybody. And it's interesting how much easier it is to get people to engage in coming to help for the horse trials. Mm. It just has a slightly different. I don't know, it has a slightly different feel to it. And I do get frustrated now, sort of, you know, with some of the, well, I was going to say particularly the event riders, because that's kind of my, you know, obviously my background.
Mm.
You know, when, for example, you know, social media is great. It has its huge benefits, but it also, you know, has its negative side. And when you see something about, you know, somebody moaning about a fence judge or moaning about somebody that, you know, I think to myself, God, that person was sat out there all day in the pouring rain, giving up their time for nothing. actually don't give them a hard time, because if we didn't have them, the sport wouldn't happen.
Yes.
You know, and I think a lot of riders perhaps aren't fully aware of that. Mm. I think it's something that, you know, could... I think if every rider was asked to help in some shape or form at an event once a year, maybe give up one day where they have to come and help,
yeah,
whether it be, you know, show jumping ring steward or dressage writing or fence judging, mm, or whatever it might be, if they had to just give up one day and come and see the behind the scenes running, I think it would do them an awful lot of good.
I totally agree. And I often, even as spectators, you know, I think we should say thank you to the people that are crossing, they're helping us to cross,
absolutely,
the track safely. And if, yeah, you know, if you're crossing the track and there's a horse coming and they scream at you to get out of the way, they're going to shout at you to get out of the way, because it's only to keep you safe.
Safe, absolutely.
And we do forget that they're doing it for the passion and their love, because, you know, 100%. Their love of the sport, which is, yeah, is amazing. But it frustrates, yeah, me, Helen, that, yeah, the show jumping people get paid. Because,
yeah,
then I think,
I know,
well, that's not fair on the eventing community, who are,
I
all
know,
you know, getting
giving
together
up their time.
Yeah.
No, it's the dynamics of it all are very interesting.
Is that through lack of funding as well? Is that through lack of support, that there isn't enough money there to be able to pay more into eventing?
I think eventing's come from a slightly different background. It's, you know, the last thing I want to make it sound is that it's elitist, but it's come from, you know, sort of military hunting, that sort of background, where, you know, people are used to perhaps, you know, giving up their day and being involved in it.
Mm.
And it just historically, that's the sort of culture.
Mm.
Show jumping's, you know, very, very different. And I mean, show jumping's changed a lot, obviously, over recent years. You know, there's an awful lot of money now floating around sort of in the sport of show jumping, you know, the Global Champions Tour, yeah, the top end jumping, it's serious, serious money. You know, those horses are worth, well, hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
Mm.
And it's become very, you know, very, very professional. And it's sort of, yeah, money talks a bit, I guess.
Well, let's look at it a glass half full kind of way. We just hope that if that pushes the equestrian industry up by money going,
absolutely,
to show jumping, then eventually it will trickle down to the other disciplines
to all the,
too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, fingers crossed anyway.
Fingers crossed. It was interesting. I was at Burley Horse Trials a few months ago, and I was sitting in on an FEI sort of seminar where the Catherine Norrinder, who's sort of the head of the FEI, the Federation Equestrian International, she was talking about the sort of proposed changes for the eventing format.
Mm.
Because they're, at the minute we have 1, 2, 3 and 4 star. So badminton is obviously the top end. Badminton and Burley are 4 star. And they're talking about bringing in another star level. So,
oh, really?
So they're bringing in a 105 class, which will be a 1 star. So everything will go up by a star. And somebody asked, you know, why is this happening? And she said, well, it's to bring it in line with, you know, show jumping goes up 5 star.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, this person, you know, sort of quite right, you know, rightly asked, well, why do we have to, you know, conform with show jumping? Why do we, eventing, why does that have to change?
Mm.
And she said, oh, show jumping is, you know, certainly under the FBI umbrella, show jumping is the sort of the top. Show jumping is the biggest sport. Show jumping is where all the money is. Show jumping is where it, you know, things matter. And she said, I'm sorry, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's the eventing that has to change to come in line with that. Which I,
wow,
thought was in, I thought was interesting. I thought that was really interesting.
Again, glass half full kind of guy.
Yeah.
You know, is positive that they're looking at enhancing the industry.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely. You know,
that
and
may
they
be.
And they're very, you know, they're very much in order to keep eventing within the Olympic format, you know, obviously people will have seen the sport of eventing's changed quite a lot over recent years.
Mm.
You know, when I first started out, it was long format. So you had your steeplechase and your roads and tracks. So you'd done sort of, you know, 5 or 6 kilometres on phase A, then you did your steeplechase, then you did 8 kilometres on phase C, had your 10-minute box, and then you went on to your cross country. And, you know, it's very, very different now. You know, long format, as it was called, is now, you know, obviously dressage on the Thursday or Friday. You do your cross country on the Saturday and you show jump on the Sunday, but you don't have any of the roads and tracks and the steeplechase. And this was very much to keep eventing in the Olympics, because what they were finding were, you know, finding venues to be able to actually host that and have the space and have, you know, obviously it's very expensive to put on a 3-day event. They just, you know, were not able to. Mm. So the short format made it easier to obviously keep eventing in the Olympics. But they're now very much wanting to make it more accessible for more nations. So again, it's kind of not dumbing it down, but it's slightly dropping down a level. So they want to have more flags. They want to have more kind of participation to keep it in the Olympics. So I think sort of certainly, you know, the next two, if it stays in, I think, you know, will look slightly different, because I think, you know, the cross country will be softened slightly in order to get greater participation from more nations.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
That doesn't mean it'll be easier. The course will be easier though, surely.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. Yeah, it does. And there's an argument, you know, obviously that the Olympics should be the absolute pinnacle and the top end of the sport. Mm. And they don't like the fact that badminton, Burley, Lexington, those what are now current four stars are actually harder. You know, they are more tough than the Olympics. But that is, you know, at the end of the day, that is a fact. They are. Mm. And the Olympic course, you know, it's well sort of accepted that it is obviously slightly easier to enable more nations to actually complete.
Goodness me. Gosh, there's lots of politics behind it,
isn't there? Oh, there's always politics. Yeah, absolutely.
So what are your thoughts on, you know, things like the Event Riders Masters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the ERM's great. You know, it's done a fantastic job at, you know, promoting eventing and getting it to the forefront of, you know, viewing. Mm. And an awful lot of money's gone into it. I have sort of, you know, I have good thoughts, and I have, you know, perhaps slightly, there's parts of it I'm not quite so keen on. I'm a little bit old-fashioned, maybe a bit traditional. I think it's changed the nature of the sport slightly. You know, again, sort of with your old long format days, you very much had to, you know, have your horse very fit, and in order to preserve your horse for the last day when you show jumped, you know, you had to ride the cross country with your head and very much make sure you had enough petrol left in the tank to, you know, in order to bring your horse out on the third day to show jump. You know, the format with the ERM, obviously they do their dressage, then they show jump, and then they go cross country in reverse order of merit. It means that obviously they haven't got anything after they've finished the cross country, so they can kind of go hell for leather and go as fast as they like cross country. And it's just changed the dynamics of it slightly. You know, I think it's great. It's done an awful lot for the sport, and I think it's, you know, overwhelmingly positive. the aspect of it that I'm not so keen on is that sometimes, you know, you get some slightly tired looking horses and some not quite so attractive pictures. And that would be my sort of slight concern moving forward.
So we need to make sure that they're focusing on horse welfare, which from all the vets that are attending and things like that, I'm sure. But and like, I guess with anything new, when you change something, there are going to be some bumps in the road, aren't there?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, there are.
So as a venue, and when you're running your CIC two-star events and your dressage competitions and your show jumping competitions, apart from the fact that you have so much to deal with in terms of staff and where people are going to go and setting out the courses and, you know, all the planning and preparation and health and safety must be an absolute nightmare.
Well, don't, yeah.
As we're in the UK as well.
Exactly.
How do you focus on horse welfare? What is it that's important to Bicton?
Interestingly enough, I actually, just to add to the kind of equation, I'm actually a course designer.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, absolutely. So I'm a British Eventing and an FEI cross-country course designer. So I design all the tracks here at Bicton. And I also have branched out and I did Nunney International in 2017, and I've also done Ballindenisk in Ireland.
That's amazing.
So yeah, no, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And again, it's really interesting because obviously when I was a rider and, you know, I used to walk the course and
you used to walk the course and say, that's rubbish, I would move that over
totally,
there.
I would do
and
that
now
that.
You can.
Absolutely. But it's funny, you know, you walk the course very much through the eyes of your horse and what you're sat on that day. So yeah, it's so different from actually putting your course designer hat on. Mm. It's fascinating. I mean, that's a whole nother ball game that I could talk for hours about.
I could talk to you for hours. Yeah. I do have a question, actually, because quite often we see, especially this year, there's been a couple of events that have had some tricky jumps where lots of people have fallen at the same jump. So how do you as a course designer work out the difference between a tricky jump and a dangerous jump?
Right. If you thought you had a dangerous jump, you shouldn't have it in there. So if I ever went to bed at night and I was really concerned about a fence on my track, I literally wouldn't sleep and I'd pull the fence out. Mm. You know, I think it's absolutely imperative that, you know, as a designer, you're 100% confident that you haven't put anything out there that is dangerous. Yes, you want to test the horses and the riders, but I mean, I've very much learned, you know, riders will make mistakes. They're only human. But it's interesting because actually, if you put two fences out, you know, that are completely unrelated, because they haven't walked it on a distance and think to themselves, right, that's going to be three strides or whatever, they'll actually make a mistake because they've almost got more time and more sort of, you know, more leeway to sort of hang themselves slightly. Mm. So certainly from a design perspective, yes, you know, you have in your head the fences that, you know, you're setting a bit of a challenge and you're, you know, you're questioning the horse or the rider. But I'm very, very sort of passionate that the questions must always be obvious to the horse. You're never out to trick the horse. You know, horses must read the question and understand it in order to obviously jump it safely. Mm. And like, you know, we've moved into the era of frangible devices. So we have pins and MIM clips that we use regularly as, you know, as designers. And, you know, there's a bit of a heated debate going on at the minute because, you know, people, the FEI, it's a strong recommendation that frangible devices should be used, but it's not actually a rule. Yeah, so obviously, you know, with some of the accidents that have happened, you know, people have, you know, understandably questioned, well, why, you know, why wasn't that fence pinned or why wasn't that fence clipped? And, you know, there's an awful lot of reasons that go into it. You know, some fences you can't do that with. And, you know, to be honest, sometimes if you feel as a designer that you need to put or you have to put device on that fence, I would question whether actually the task you're setting the horse or rider is right, because you shouldn't need to. Mm. You know, there's fences that statistically, you know, we know horses are more likely to make a mistake at or are more likely to cause a fall. And for example, like an open oxer or an open corner, we would always pin the front rail and reverse pin the back rail. Mm. And I think, you know, that's very sort of established now, certainly in this country. It's probably more in the sort of when I say lesser countries, I don't mean lesser countries, but, you know, the
no, I know what
countries
you mean.
That, you know what yeah. I mean? It's more in those countries that perhaps fences appear that aren't, you know, built to the standard that they should be, and that, you know, perhaps don't use the devices that, you know, we have access to over here.
Mm. So much to go into it. I do have a question about your coaching, not your coaching individually, but your coaching at Bicton, because a recent question that's come, and I admire your honesty, Helen. Thank you so much.
No, not at all.
A question that has come up a lot recently in venues and riding schools is the ability for the ability of the instructors, their qualifications. You touched on the law and the fact there are no regulations with safety. Well, there are no regulations with instructors either as to what qualification they have to be able to instruct. And I'm hearing more and more and more that unqualified people are instructing students that maybe shouldn't be. In my opinion, they shouldn't be, because they're not insured, for one. There's safety implications if they're not making sure that the health and safety implications, but safety implications of the rider. They won't be well equipped to deal with things if
Absolutely.
Something happens to the horse. So as a venue, you know, and you are a huge venue, so I know that all your riders will be professionals, but what advice can you give to riding schools that are struggling, that don't have much money to be able to pay for, you know, top level instructors, to make sure that their riding school is the best that it can be and the safest?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important to promote some of our, you know, our younger, enthusiastic, like, for example, another DC, I'm also DC of our local pony club, okay? And, you know, I look at some of the kids that have grown up through the pony club, and, you know, one thing the pony club does do incredibly well is the horsemanship side of things. And that's where, you know, I really think that, you know, that's a really good thing about the pony club. And some of these, you know, these kids that have grown up through the pony club and come and helped at camp, and, you know, helped with the little ones, those, you know, those girls I look at, I think, gosh, you know, let's put some training into them. Let's send them, let's get their first aid. Let's get, you know, let's get them all the sort of credentials they need, all the boxes ticked. Why don't we put them through that so that we can then actually use them and put them back into the system?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to be encouraging them, and we want to encourage younger trainers to do things properly and to go through the system and to get, you know, to get those boxes ticked, to then be safe and to be able to send out and coach, you know, our younger members. And whether, you know, riding schools could look at something similar, because, you know, I'm sure there's always children that have kind of grown up through that riding school that are very involved with it, that perhaps, you know, with a bit of encouragement, you know, would like to perhaps go down that route. And if they were in a position, you know, to be able to put them through the training, get their first aid and actually then put them back into the riding school to help, I think that would sort of, you know, be a good starting point, certainly.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because a lot of riding schools are struggling now. You know,
yeah,
there isn't a lot of money in the industry. There's not a lot of money anywhere at the moment, not just in the equestrian industry.
But you're right. It is very, very, I do think it is very important. And I mean, we had an awful tragic incident actually at Bicton in 2016, where somebody I knew very well actually was having a private lesson with a very, very qualified instructor. And she had a stupid fall and died. You know, she lost her life. I mean, horrific. Absolutely horrific.
I'm sorry to hear that,
Helen. Yeah, no, it was. It was awful. And the only thing I can say is, you know, thank God, like, the person she was having the the lesson with was a UKCC level 3 coach. You know, we were at Bicton. It was on, you know, a fantastic surface. It was using a BS, you know, top set of show jumps. We had safety cups. You know, we've got notices everywhere. You know, I know it sounds awful, but from, you know, from our venue's perspective, you know, we'd done everything right that we possibly could. And actually, you know, when the sort of coroner's verdict came out, she said it just was such a tragic accident. She said, but it couldn't have happened at a better place, you know. And it sounds awful as a kind of backhanded compliment.
Well, no, not at all, because you could deal with it, and you were equipped to deal with it.
Totally. We even have like a defibrillator here. I'm lucky because obviously Bicton is owned by Clinton Devon Estates. It's a 23 generation family business, you know, and it's great to have that kind of backing from them. Mm. But in the estate office, we do everything properly. They're very hot on their health and safety, and we have a defib in the office. So to have been able to have access to that, you know, when it happened was amazing. Mm. And obviously, sadly, it didn't save her life on this occasion, but on a lot of occasions, that would have made a massive difference. And if you'd been out in some, you know, not great school somewhere with fences that weren't up to standard, you know, with no first aid help at all, I mean, and with an instructor that wasn't qualified and wasn't insured, it would just be a nightmare. And that scares me.
It scares the life out of me as well. Recently, I had an accident back in March. I lost my memory.
That's really scary.
And it was very similar to that. It was a simple accident, nothing major. I just happened to fall off, lost my balance.
Yep.
The air vest went off, spooked the horse, and I got kicked in the head.
That's
what it was. Thank goodness for my coach, because, you know, she's a high-level coach, qualified, knew straight away what to do. What scares me is you've got these young kids and young adults that aren't qualified, that are coaching four kids at the same time in a riding school. I feel for the riding school, because a lot of the time the riding schools don't know what they're supposed to be doing. I'm hoping that by talking about it, we can show that there are other ways, and that
absolutely,
you know, we want to help the youngsters come through with apprenticeships too.
Yeah, we do.
So they can be involved in it, but they can shadow a qualified instructor.
Absolutely, yeah. And there must be so many opportunities for them to do that.
Mm. My goodness, Helen, I could talk to you for hours. You are my new best friend.
Oh, bless you. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Maybe one day you could come back on and we can put the world to rights and
rights
another
again.
Thing.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I'd be delighted to.
So you've got lots of great things going on at Bicton over the winter to help people with their training, getting ready for competitions next year. So have you got a website that we can go and have a look at?
Absolutely, we do. Yes. It is a www.bicton-arena.co.uk.
Perfect. And so
do go and check it out.
We have Horse Hour every Monday night on Twitter, and we do tweet all week. But if you want to get involved in the networking hour and you'd like to follow Bicton Arena, then Helen, what's your Twitter handle?
It is Bicton Arena.
Perfect. So we can follow that. And I guess you're on Facebook and Instagram.
We
and
are. Absolutely.
Now,
don't be afraid of us on Facebook.
Don't be afraid of social, Helen, because our community are very friendly, and we only do.
Fantastic.
We don't stand for any negativity. We only want supportive people.
Brilliant.
So
yes.
Thank you so much. I'm going to come and visit you very soon.
You'd be welcome anytime.
Thank
Please
you.
Do.
I'll see you.
See you then. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Helen's sponsored by Horse Age, which is a high-quality, dust-free bagged forage available in four varieties: high fibre, timothy, ryegrass and alfalfa. They offer a choice suitable for all types of horses and ponies, including those prone to laminitis. The company is the official forage supplier for Horse of the Year Show and the British Equestrian Team. If you want more information on Horse Age, head to www.horseage.co.uk. Well, there's lots more coming up on the Horse Hour podcast on the next few weeks, including Emily King. Really looking forward to you hearing her interview. And also, I got a chat with her mum, Mary King, too. I've lined up some veterinary advice for you. So when we're going into the winter months, I thought it was important to see how we look after our horses in the winter. And in particular, I'll be speaking to B&W Equine Vets about acorns, because they're rife at the moment. Are you struggling with acorns? I've got an acorn tree in the field, which is a nightmare because it only sprouts acorns about once every 3 years. But right now, they've got more than they've ever had, so I've had to section it off. So I'm interested to hear how acorns affect the horses, how dangerous are they really, and how can we manage acorns. If you have any questions that you'd like me to ask B&W Equine Vets, then drop us a tweet at Horse Hour. Of course, you can message us on Facebook as well. It's exactly the same, at Horse Hour, and Instagram as well. Don't forget, every Monday night between 8 and 9, we all get together, equestrians from all over the world, talk to each other just by using the hashtag Horse Hour. So if you'd like to share your journey, your story, your pictures, your videos, anything that you've been up to with your horse, or if you'd like to get some advice, then just use hashtag Horse Hour.
There's lots more of information and education on our website if you head to horsehour.co.uk. I hope you have a great week with your horse, and I'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to Horse Hour. Join the community on Twitter, Mondays, 8pm UK time, 3pm Eastern, by using the hashtag Horse Hour. Follow Amy at AmyStevenson1 and subscribe to us on Acast, iTunes, Stitcher and Player FM.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.